Welcome to Wild and Awake, an online retreat where you deepen your consciousness, arouse your courage, and choose with wisdom. We are exploring the question, how do I live my best life right now? I am your host, Kari Vantine. Hello, everyone. Welcome again to Wild and Awake. And today we are so blessed to have with us Carol Briskin. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you.
I'd like to share a little bit about Carol before we dive in. Carol Briskin is a certified trauma professional and board certified polarity practitioner with 40 years of experience. She began studying energy medicine before it entered the mainstream culture. So did I. It's now very mainstream. Fascinated by the idea of increasing and balancing life force, Carol expanded her skills to include craniosacral work, foot reflexology, nervous system balancing, Reiki, transformational breathwork, and trauma-informed counseling. Carol has presented her work nationally for the American Polarity Therapy Association and served on a panel of experts for both the American Massage Therapy Association and Arizona State University School of Complementary Medicine. And she is a referring therapist for The Meadows, an internationally known trauma and addiction center in Wickenburg, Arizona. Carol is passionate about life force, building it, freeing it, and cultivating its journey through the streams and eddies of a body. She believes firmly in Carl Jung's assertion that beneath the wound lies the genius. And by consciously entering the portal of our deepest wounding, we find our greatest gifts. And with that, I just love that last line, Carol. I absolutely love that last line and would say that our journey today is in many ways exploring together and finding our greatest gifts within this deepest wounding.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Today, we're going to dive into Carol's work, but I'd like to start with this overarching question that I've been asking all of the speakers. This event is titled Wild and Awake. How do I live my best life right now? Carol, how do you envision that we're able to live our best lives right now? And what makes our lives well-lived? And from your perspective and work, what are the elements we could bring in that might make our lives better? Over the course of this interview, I realize we'll be answering this question in many forms and many dimensions. But Carol, what is your first response to this question?
Well, my first response to this question is I love this question because it is a question you live your way into. One of my favorite, all-time favorite quotes is from Rilke, the poet Rilke, who says, "Try to be patient towards all that is unresolved in your heart and learn to love the questions themselves." You will not be given the answers because you cannot live the answers. And the point is to live everything. Live the question. And then one day, perhaps without even noticing it, you will live your way into the answer. That is, to me, those are the questions really worth asking, the ones you live your way into the answer. And if I had a client who was asking me that question, there's a particular practice that I love, and I would give them this practice. So I'm going to say it right now. And that is, I used to have a teacher who said, you open a can with a can opener, you open your mind with a question. Mm-hmm. So if there's a question that you want to live your way into, you just take the question, put it on a sticky note pad, right? Stick it on your bathroom mirror. And every morning when you're brushing your teeth, you just let the question sink into your consciousness. And you don't try to answer it. You don't answer it in a linear way. Well, this would be my wild and awake life. Like, no. You ask. And in fact, I did this when you emailed me. I actually put it on a sticky note and I wrote, what would make today well lived? And then you don't answer that question. You just open your mind and you start watching. What is life bringing to you? What is being presented to you? And through that very active dance, that partnership with life, the question, you live your way into the answer. So that's what I loved about that.
Thank you, Carol. That's such a beautiful segue and also into our work together today. It's this concept of actually living like the answers that we might actually get in this very moment aren't the same that we're going to get in 5 minutes from now or a month from now or a year from now. And yeah, part of that, I believe, is this piece around that we are a constantly evolving, growing being.
Yes.
And I've always loved this bumper sticker. To me, it's a funny one. It's the I'm a spiritual being in a physical body. Mm-hmm. Right? And so in this concept of being physical being and a spiritual body, how does that play out in your work? How do you see us being a physical body and a spiritual being coming together?
Yes. Well, that is, that really speaks to the core of what polarity work is about. Because polarity says, and that's the foundational work that I do is polarity work. Polarity says everything is energy and it exists on this big continuum. So the continuum includes the densest of the dense and the highest of the high. And everything is along that rainbow. Everything is along that spectrum. So the first distinction to make, I know I grew up in a very religious home, and my training was God's up there and he's male and he's, you know, watching over us and we're down here and we have to pray to him and supplicate him and hope that he hears our prayers. And there was this tremendous division between these tiny little, yes, humans and this big, almighty, omnipotent God. And it was so mind-altering to me when I first came to polarity and they said, No, it's all on one continuum of energy. So there's no split between your human physical body, and God. You are the manifestation of God in a step down of energy. So Dr. Stone talked about a step down of energy where he said, you know, it starts with the formless, with the level of the ethers, where it's,
Carol, can I just pause you? Dr. Stone is one of the founders of polarity. Is that
correct? Thank you. Yes. Dr. Stone is the founder of polarity. It's based on his work. So he said that, it begins with this spacious, open, formless, etheric realm. And then it steps down into the air element, the fire element, the water element, and finally into the earth, which is the clay of our bodies. And he used to make the analogy of water, that when the temperature was very high, water takes the form of steam and vapor. You know, it's very spacious, it's very open, fills the room. The temperature drops and it condenses into water. It's fluid. And, you know, even in our own lives, we'll say, oh, we're going with the flow when we're in the fluidity of life and we feel like we're moving. And then the temperature drops again and it hardens into ice. And now it's hard and now it's like a rock and you need an ice pick to, you know, chip away at it. And I think all of us can relate when we feel our tension patterns in our bodies, you know, we densify as our frequency lowers. And so one of the principles of polarity work was, if you want to begin to shift and metamorphosize your body, you raise the vibration of it. You get the energy to move and you start moving along the continuum. So polarity has this extremely fluid view of our bodies. It has this extremely fluid view even of illness and disease. It's like, okay, this is what your body is expressing right now. But if we trace it to the origin and consciousness, what is the consciousness trying to express? And is there a healthier way to express it? And how do we play with that vibrationally so that the energy can move and can dance?
Ooh, what a beautiful description. And so if I'm correct, the denser form then would also, you know, it would be water turning to ice, but it would also be us in this physical body. That would be the denser form, and then the trajectory up going into our more spiritual being. Yes.
And in fact, that's exactly what Dr. Stone talks about when he talks about God coming into this physical body is involution. And what we are here to do as human beings, our greater spiritual purpose is evolution, which is dense matter rising and returning home to spirit. So that's exactly right. And there's a constant move. And that's one of the fundamental pulsations of the universe that Dr. Stone talked about, a healthy being. And when I work with people, when I work with my clients, I'm always looking at where is this person pulsing in a way that's healthy? And then where is this person stuck? And they're not able to pulse. And so the movement, like when people say, oh, I just feel so stuck in my life, I guarantee you their nervous system is stuck. I mean, because that's what that feeling of stuckness is. And if you can restore pulsation at a somatic level, you are not stuck anymore. Everything.
I love that you're saying that. Actually, one of the impulses for this event was because I was hearing over and over from people how they were feeling that their lives weren't quite what they wanted them to be, that they were stuck in some way, or you know, even if they were living a good life, which had all the pieces in place that they've been told that they're supposed to do, there was a feeling of something being off or feeling of something not quite being reached. And so I love what you're saying here too, is that we can actually feel that within this physical form and energetic. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, that's the blueprint, that when we feel we're stuck, that's the tip of the iceberg. If you trace it back, there was something that got stuck energetically before you registered that you're stuck. So if you can find the origin in the energetic pulse and release it there, and basically it comes down to just some form of resistance, which is the most human thing in the world. I sort of want to destigmatize resistance, you know, because we have such a shame-based view of it. Oh, I'm resisting and therefore I'm bad. It's like, no, human beings resist. That's part of the human experience. We resist when we feel some sort of threat. So, and then if that doesn't get discharged, if the charge doesn't get released, we can start to be stuck. Once we restore pulsation, once we restore the free flow of energy, the stuckness somatically releases, and then the feeling of stuckness that we've been attributing to our lives also releases. And then the way starts to become clear.
Mm. That makes a lot of sense. Carol, what you're talking about in this sort of unfolding feels like what I understand to be trauma, both little t and big t trauma, and also the body's patterns for holding or maybe even taking care of itself by holding tight. Would you be willing to unfold for us a little bit about trauma and the body's patterns for being able to, I think of it as protect itself, but in that way, it's also keeping us shut down.
Well, you just named it, you know, you just named to me, one of the great ironies is that I got into this work because of my own trauma, and I can tell that story if you want to hear it, but I was living in a tremendously traumatized body. And so I had to, you know, I didn't have much choice. I'm quite clear that I came into this life to be the archetype of the wounded healer because I was wounded so early on. And mm-hmm. So the irony that I'm referring to is that the very things that at one time protected us, at one time gave us a feeling of safety or at least control, some capacity to manage an overwhelming situation, it's those very things that cut off our life force later in our lives. So much of the journey, and Meister Eckhart said this, he said, the spiritual journey is one of subtraction, not addition. You're not trying to add on things. You're stripping away everything that's not you, not you, not you. Do you, I see you laughing. Do you know that?
I love that. I love that. Yes.
Michelangelo, right?
Who's, wait, if, oh my gosh. When they ask, stone.
Yeah. And he said, I chip away at everything that's not the statue. I look at the piece of marble, I walk around it, and then I start chipping away everything that's not the statue. And that is the spiritual journey. It also happens to be the somatic journey, that you start chipping away at everything that's not the truth of who you are, that's not your essence. So you're just gently beginning to chip away. And you have to be delicate about it, because these defenses were put in place as life protection defenses. So they're not going to just go, oh, okay, I guess I'm not needed anymore. See ya. They're going to hold with quite a bit of tenacity. So you're very gently approaching and moving with these defenses to allow them to see that there is a deeper level of safety present now, that they are not young children, that they are not without resources, that there is now available to them almost a reservoir of safety that you can just begin to dip into. And the reason I use that analogy is in trauma healing, we talk about titration, which is if we braced, if we cut off our breathing, if we cut off our movement because we were in a threat response of some type, then the way to come out of that threat response is to build first a reservoir of safety and take a little thimble full of trauma and pour it into the reservoir. It's like one of my teachers would say,
like homeopathic.
Like if you have a shot glass of dye and you pour it into a big swimming pool, the dye just disperses and it's gone. And that's how we work with trauma. We take a shot glass of trauma and we pour it into a reservoir of safety. And then we go back and take the next shot glass of trauma.
Thank you. And this image of trauma, from my understanding, and I think that the trauma conversation is actually something that's become more and more mainstream, which has actually been really exciting to me to see that we're talking about it and people are owning it. And it's not just something you secretly talk about with your therapist, but we're actually looking at our bodies as, I love the book that the body keeps the score.
Yes. Yes.
The body is keeping the information, mm-hmm. and that there are, ways to unravel it, which is part of what you're talking about. But first I'd love to name the patterns that we are showing up in trauma.
Yes. I love to name the patterns that are showing up in trauma because it shines so much light on what's going on at a deeper level. We have a saying in the trauma field, unmetabolized trauma becomes personality.
Oh, that's so perfect. Yes.
So perfect. So
first of all, what do you mean by that for those who are listening? Because that's a great line, but what's going on underneath there?
So what's going on underneath is, let's say, for example, most people are familiar with the flight response, right? We know there are four threat responses: fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. Those are the four. And most people are quite familiar with fight or flight. We know that when there's a predator, when there's a threat, the body mobilizes to fight the enemy or to run like hell and get away to safety. So let's just say you're in the flight portion of your threat response. You're running like hell. How that can show up if it is unresolved in a person, how that shows up as personality is it's a go, go, go personality. They're constantly running. So they have a to-do list that is impossible to get done in a day. And when they look at that to-do list, some part of them knows there's no way I can get all this done in one day. And that's adrenalizing because they start to pump that adrenaline in order to rev up to get all these things done. And they're the people who, no matter what they do, they say, I can't relax. I'm always restless. I can't relax. I just have a go, go, go personality. And I do have to, So first of all, I want to say that's not your personality. You're locked in your threat response of flight. And secondly, I want to say that we have a cultural preference for that response because we are rewarded quite strongly for going, going, going. I remember I grew up in New York City and they used to brag they're the city that never sleeps. And I used to think, honey, if a person
sleeps,
exactly. They become psychotic. Why are you bragging that you never sleep? I wouldn't be proud of that if I were you. But that is, you know, the pride of New York City. We never sleep. We never slow down. We never stop. We suck it up and we soldier on. And so there is that cultural bias, and people who are those kind of go-getters and high producers, they get rewarded very well in this culture. But what's happening is we're being rewarded for a threat response. And sooner or later, and this is why you see such an epidemic of burnout, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, autoimmune. I mean, like, we're looking at it going, what is going on? And what happens is all of these responses, a threat response is a short-term solution to a very immediate threat. Right? It's the mom.
That's how it's designed.
That's right? What it's supposed to be. It's the mom lifting the car off the baby. But as I'll often say, okay, lifting a car off the baby should not be your daily workout schedule, right? It's a short-term response. Instead, we take it on as a lifestyle. And when the body is adrenalized at that level, you start to burn out. We were never designed to be inside of a go, go, go system. That's not our rhythm. Our rhythm is inhale, exhale, heartbeat, and heartbeat back, you know, into the arteries, back and through the veins. We're designed to pulsate, to expand and contract rhythmically. We are not designed to keep going, going, going. And so if you do that long enough, you will start burning out your system and you'll start having these very stress-related illnesses, which we're seeing so much of. So that's if you're caught in the flight response. If you're caught in a fight response, you're a badass. You know, you're like one of those people who have anger management issues, right? You're irritable. Everything pisses you off. People piss you off. You hate waiting in line. You know, there's this kind of heat that's always rolling because you're always bracing for a fight. You know, you are locked into fight response. And so everything irritates you. People who are frustrated a lot, those are, you know, and, you know, people who are the troublemakers, you know, like people who go looking for a fight, that's going to be locked into that fight response. Mm-hmm. If you're locked into freeze, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to say that I'm guessing too, like, you know, the behavior creates the trauma creates the personality, but mm-hmm. I would also say that there's a way in which the, like I think of, you know, being on the highway and having people honking their horns, like that experience of, it's also relating to whatever comes up as though it's attacking. So there's something that's happening in the psychology of responding to the world around us as though it's attacking, or responding to it as though it's something I need to run from.
Right. Exactly. I mean, well, what you're describing is that's the definition of post-traumatic stress. When a present time issue triggers a past issue. And part of the way you know you're in a trauma response is your response is disproportionate to the actual event. So somebody cuts you off in traffic, and that is scary. I mean, you know, that is scary when someone gets too close to your car, because cars can kill you. But if you really have this huge rage reaction to it, that's just so disproportionate to what actually happened, then what is happening is that event is triggering an early event that was genuinely life and death, and they're merged. And we call that coupling. In the trauma field, we call that coupling, because the brain is associative in its behavior, which is why if your mom wore a certain kind of perfume, years later, you smell that perfume and you think of your mom, you know, because the mind coupled that perfume with your mother. And the mind works that way. So it's very easy for present time circumstances to trigger these past events.
That makes sense. Thank you. Thanks for taking that little segue, because it felt important to me to also see, like, how does this fit into the bigger container?
Exactly. And the thing about trauma is it all becomes a feedback loop. So, and that's kind of what you're describing. So we're living from the past, and we're not living in present time, but then present time starts to reinforce what we're living from. And so we keep having, so it's like, so people will look at me and they'll go, no, but I really have all these things to do. You know, no, it's, you know, I really do have to do all these things. And when they're locked in their reality, they really do. But in fact, it's coming from a deeper, more underground pattern of energy. Mm-hmm. It's coming from someplace that's deeper and more unconscious. And that's so much of the work of, that's why when you talked about wild and awake, you know, mm-hmm. wild for me is accessing your energy, accessing your primitive, primal, magnificent, you know, foundational energy. But awake is being conscious of what is really going on. So as you start to unwind trauma, people start having a lot of ahas. They start understanding, oh, this is why I'm this way. Oh, this is why I reacted to this other thing. And as they start to unwind from it energetically, it starts to unwind in their life. And that's what I love to see.
That makes a lot of sense. You were going to move on to the what I've heard of, right? This fight, flight,
freeze, and fawn.
And I've also heard freeze is referred to as play dead, which.
Yes. And I'll tell you why that is. So freeze is the last ditch effort. In other words, fight or flight is our first mobilization. If there's a threat, there's an immediate assessing of the situation. If I'm bigger and stronger, I'm going to go in for the kill. I'm going to go towards the enemy and try and kick the shit out of it. If I'm smaller but faster, then I'm going to run, because that's my, you assess very quickly, what's my survival chances?
Do what's going to save your life.
Yes, what's going to save your life? Exactly. And by the way, anything that saves your life was the right thing to do, because when you're in survival, the name of the game is survive. So whatever does that, whatever achieves that goal, that was the right thing to do. When it comes to freeze, you're talking, I'll talk about it both from the human standpoint and the animal standpoint. From the human standpoint, we're talking oftentimes about young children who are in a home that is unsafe for them. There's an alcoholic parent, there's a drug addicted parent, there's a mentally ill parent, there's something going on. Or it could just be that they have two traumatized parents who don't recognize how they're transmitting that trauma to their kids. They're just unaware. So whatever the root of it is, they're living chronically in an environment of non-safety. Now, they can't fight their parents, right? And they can't flee. They're not going to qualify for a mortgage at age 4. So they are stuck. They can't, those two mobilizations that would be the natural way to respond are not going to work in a situation like this. So they go to the next level, which is freeze. And that is also called playing possum. In the wild, when a prey animal realizes, I'm not going to be able to get away, and I'm not big enough to fight this predator, what it will do is it will mimic death. It will seem as though it's already dead. And the reason for that is predators want a fresh kill. And if they can be convinced that the prey animal was dead before they got there, they might very well leave, because animals that have been dead for a while carry infection. And, you know, at an instinctive level, predators know that. So what they'll do is they'll bat the animal around for a while. If the animal remains limp and lifeless and appears dead, they might very well walk away. And then once the prey animal, you know, smells the wind and can see that they're safe, they're up and they save their lives. So they were able to save their life by mimicking death. And in people, how that shows up, which is very similar, is there's a mobilization, but then there's a stop on the mobilization. I can't fight. I can't run. So I have to freeze and become very small. Oftentimes, these are children who become needless and wantless. They learn that part of their survival strategy is to be invisible. You know, they just become, it's get very small and try not to get noticed. And that is a survival strategy. But what's happening is, this is a very high intensity state, because it can look like calm since it's frozen, nothing's happening. But in fact, all of that adrenaline that mobilized to fight and to run, it didn't go anywhere. It's now boom, It's frozen in the tissue.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
So there's two, exactly. I feel like doing the same thing because it's this, we call it tonic immobility. It's just the person becomes immobilized. And that's also when someone's in that tonic immobility, they'll also going to be stuck because they really are stuck. There's a push to fight or run, being immediately smothered by the fact that it's not safe to express any of that. So you have two conflicting energies pushing against each other. I see this all the time. And it's also the source of a lot of very common illnesses, like, for example, insomnia. The person is really, really tired, but they can't fall asleep because they're adrenalized and frozen at the same time. Do not confuse. And sometimes it will also get diagnosed as depression because they can't get out of bed in the morning, but there's really a high activation state going on right underneath that freeze response. So that's what I work with more than anything else, is that chronic freeze response.
And I wanted to say, Carol, that the things that you're talking about are, to me, sound also like very normal people I see around me. I could categorize in these as well as parts of myself.
Yes.
So I just want to normalize that we're talking about trauma is actually something that I think most of our culture is experiencing on some level. Is that fair?
That is absolutely fair. And thank you so much for saying that, because I feel like part of my mission in life is to destigmatize this and raise awareness around it. So we tend to think of trauma as, you know, soldiers coming back from Afghanistan, and God knows they have their share of trauma. But trauma is actually very, very much a daily occurrence. And many people are playing these things out. We all know people who have these things. And look at the widespreadness of insomnia, and look at the widespreadness of digestive disorders, because that's the other thing. You have to be in parasympathetic to digest well. In fact, parasympathetic is that there's two sides to the nervous system, sympathetic, parasympathetic. And parasympathetic is in fact called rest and digest. That's even why it's called that. Because for the healthy digestion of our food, we need to have a certain amount of relaxation. You have to realize if you're running from the tiger, you're not snacking during that time. Yes, no. You need your blood in your legs to run.
The stomach actually stops digesting, right? We're on
pause. Exactly. The body stops digesting because it's much more important that the legs get the blood flow and the arms get the blood flow so that you can run and you can punch and you can do whatever you need to do to survive the threat. And it completely leaves the abdominal viscera. It completely leaves the digestive tract. So when people are inhabiting more of their sympathetic nervous system, their go, go, go side, then they can't digest their food. So we see this unbelievable explosion of all kinds of digestive issues, from irritable bowel to diverticulitis to acid reflux. I mean, there's just so many different things. And so much of the root of that is nervous system balancing. When you can balance your nervous system, this all recalibrates.
Thank you. And then the fourth category, which is actually one that I find that I work a lot with my clients, that I'm just fascinating, is the fawn. And one of the ways that I see it is that people are trying to protect themselves in an environment that might not feel safe, but is actually so normalized, like the workspace or a relationship. Could you unfold with us?
Absolutely. Yes. Well, fawning is, there's two attributes to fawning that, you know, you're in the fawn response is when you're trying to appease the predator. So it's being obsequious, it's being submissive, deferential. It's, you know, it's turning all of your attention outward and watching the object of your fawning, you know, watching their facial expression, their body language. How can I please this person? I'm only safe if they are pleased. So it is an attempt to achieve safety. And the two hallmarks of fawning is it's reflexive and it's performative. So reflexive is it's just knee jerk. You do it without even recognizing it. And it's performative, meaning, and we see this every day, hi, have a nice day. You know, it's got that very adrenalized, performance oriented social facade. And that's how you know you're fawning. Now, fawning is so much part of the culture. You have individual fawning and then you have cultural fawning. I grew up in a home that was Orthodox Jewish, Eastern European. My parents were Eastern European immigrants from Lithuania, and they were older. So their consciousness was 1920s consciousness, and their consciousness was how life was lived in these little Jewish ghettos in Lithuania before they came to this country. Well, Orthodox Judaism is a highly patriarchal structure, And so within the entire culture, women are taught to fawn on men because men have the power. It's a domination culture of men over women. And if women are going to be protected and if women are going to be safe, and really, you know, if women are going to survive, this was my mother's reality. If women are going to survive, they had better appease the man who's in charge of their survival. And, you know, so you have an entire gender fawning that is woven into the fabric of the culture. I'm still working on it. Years after.
It's woven into the fabric of our culture. I mean, you can look at advertisement. It's not hard to see it everywhere.
Yes.
Everywhere, this this idea that they're supposed to be, women are supposed to please in some way. We might not finish the sentence today. We're supposed to please in order to stay safe and alive.
But that is exactly it. And one thing that I do want to add about it, first of all, I just want to acknowledge that, as one of my teachers often says, the memory of DNA is long. So I just want to honor that for many thousands of years, women's survival really did depend on appeasing men. Let's not kid ourselves about that. It's only been the last 50 years, maybe, quite even, which is a blink of an eye in terms of history, that women have had the capacity to take care of themselves and not have to appease a man for their survival. So, you know, we're talking, let's see, the Jewish calendar is 5,700 years versus 50 years. So, you know, this pattern is not going to change very fast. The best you can do is be conscious of it. But the thing that I know has helped me in terms of working with my own fawning is the knowledge that what you're really afraid of when you're fawning is you're afraid of a rupture in the relationship. Mm. That's what is the threat. The threat is this relationship could somehow suffer a disconnection, could somehow suffer a break, and we may not have the skills to repair it.
Yes.
So, and then that brings in separation, abandonment, all of, you know, loss, grief. So that brings in much deeper motivations that keep people fawning.
Hmm. Oh, this is powerful work. This is just, I love these distinctions. And given, you know, we could play in this territory for a long time, and this is what you do for your work. And I'm curious if you could give us a little bit on how it is that we actually heal or shift these behaviors, because this, you know, in this place of the body remembering or keeping the score, and our original conversation of the body being the densest energy field, like I see around me, this being stuck.
Yes.
How do we start unsticking it?
Yes, that's such a great question. And that is the work. And I can tell you that is always a dance in this, because you're always looking at how can I unstick it for this person. It's not just in general, how do I unstick it? How do I have this person begin to move out of immobilization? When I work both online and in person, when I'm working in person, what's lovely is I've got the option of hands-on techniques that were created by Dr. Stone, who was a chiropractor, an osteopath, and a naturopathic physician. And so his view of the human organism, of the human body, is that we're little miniatures of planet Earth. We have a north pole at the top of the head, south pole at the base of the feet, and we have lines of current that move through us and around us, and all the meridians and the Chinese meridians and the nadis and the chakras. And, you know, we have all these energy centers. So he designed a number of techniques. And I think people might be familiar with craniosacral work, mm-hmm. where you're working at the head and you're actually working throughout the body. You have listening stations, but you're listening.
North Pole.
That's exactly it. Working up to the North Pole. And you're listening for the cerebrospinal fluid, for the movement of the cerebrospinal fluid, which is the ionically charged fluid that washes over the entire nervous system, washes up the spine, over the brain, and down again. And just like our breath has an inhalation and an exhalation, and our heartbeat, you know, pushes out into the arteries, back through the veins, so too our cerebrospinal fluid has a rhythm of filling and emptying and filling and emptying. When we have trauma, that rhythm gets disrupted. So one of the things that can restore a person's rhythmic integrity is to listen for the movement of that cerebrospinal fluid and do the cranial interventions that begin to free the fluid through the tissue. And when that foundational pattern starts to open, what starts to open is the whole person, the whole being starts to open. Now you've got the feedback loop from another piece, which is, this is one of the hardest parts about working with trauma. When people were first traumatized, they constricted as a response to the threat. What happens is constriction gets coupled with safety, and they start.
Oh, interesting. Yes. Yeah.
Ooh, and they start to think, I'm safe because I'm braced. I'm safe because I'm tense. I'm safe because I'm
constricted. Interesting. Yes.
So when I start working with people and I start opening up their bodies and their breathing starts opening, and I invite them to make sound and vibrate, and I invite them to move, and we start to free up energy, the first thing that comes up is, I'm not going to be safe. I'm not going to, you know, and if the pattern was, I stay safe by not being noticed, you're going to be noticed if you're breathing and you're sounding and you're moving.
Yeah.
And so these very deep, really, really primitive associations of constriction equals safety, expansion equals danger, will start to rise in people's consciousness. And we have to really start working with that very, very slowly again, to start to create a safety around freedom, a safety around expansion. And then we go back and we expand some more at the somatic level. And then we come back to the psychological level, and we're weaving constantly in between, which is why, you know, I always say that really deep somatic transformational work is a death rebirth process. You are literally dying to the identity that you have had and to all of your associations with safety and danger, and you are birthing yourself into your into the next version of who you are. But it really is a tremendous falling away of patterns,
especially if the patterns are so tied into an identity, right? So if this pattern unfurls and the identity changes, and then the person is being run by or driven by or running away from or frozen in, there's actually a whole space of identity that gets to be discovered.
Which I love that you're putting it that way. Usually people walk
terrifying.
In. Exactly.
I say, I don't know what I'm anymore. Yes.
I don't know who I am anymore.
Yes.
So, at one point, and I have learned over time, I've matured as a therapist, I'm happy to say, because I remember this happening, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago. At one point, I was doing additional work in neurofeedback. I got certified as a neurofeedback practitioner, which is like biofeedback, but for the nervous system. So, and the particular company that trained me, their attitude was, we're going to power through this. So the format of it, the structure was that people would pay massive amounts of money, and we would do two sessions a day, two and a half hour sessions a day. So
wow.
5 hours a day, 5 days in a row, putting electrodes on this person's scalp and on the computer screen, we would see the brainwave activity being played out, and they were musically being fed back what their brainwave activity was. And there were ways that they were being trained to make changes into their in their brainwave activity to give them a more healthy meditative brain. But it was so radical, it was so intense, that I remember one of my clients walking in on the third day going, I don't know who I am anymore. And in that moment, I was a young therapist. I remember saying, but that's great. You hated who you were. And she looked at me like, have you no empathy? Did you just miss that day at therapy school when they taught you about compassion? What is wrong with you? You know? And I kind of learned, okay, not a good response. So now I'm much more compassionate and empathetic about, yes, you know, then we really talk about how this is, how scary it is to lose the patterns that you have hinged your identity on.
Mm. Wow. That is really incredible. I would, there's so many threads I want to pull right now, but Carol, I'm going to ask, can you take us down the path of actually bringing a little bit of doing a little routine with us, actually, because I'd love for everybody right now, if you don't mind, to show us what it feels like to actually
free up some energy,
up a little bit of energy. Because what we're talking about right now, and just to clarify, if I'm correct on this, is all of these patterns that are stuck in the we're talking about personality, but this is actually energy. Right?
Yes. Yes.
It's energy.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But energy is what underlies personality. So we're really looking at, and that's what I love about this work, is we're looking at the underpinnings of personality. We're looking at the origins and consciousness, what gives rise to personality, and how do we work at that underground level to begin to create change. But I love your idea, which is what I've been talking about is very activating, because just about everyone can relate in some way.
Oh my gosh. And I can imagine everybody who's watching this right now. And I hope that you're tuning in enough to actually feel all the things in your system of like, oh, that's me. And that's me. And that's me. And that's me. So I'd love for this incredible, these physical beings right now to maybe have a little release in that. If you could leave
Absolutely.
Us something.
So I'm just going to take off my glasses here and, you know, kind of get myself ready for some movement and from sound. And what I'd like to do first is just invite people to do exactly what you said. Just check in with yourself. This was a lot of information. I probably told you stuff that it took me 3 years in school to, you know, really integrate. So just check in and see, how is your heartbeat? How's your breath? Can you take a moment to feel your body resting on your chair? Maybe you're on a sofa, a bed, whatever surface you are resting on. Take a moment to feel the weight of your body up against that surface. And now notice if there's any activation. An activation would be your heart's beating rapidly. You feel charged up in some way. And I'm going to invite you, since sound is such a healing power, and sound will carry the vibration of charge out of your body. I'm going to invite you to just take a deep breath and let out a sound. And here we go. Yes. Once again, breathing in and sound. Nice. And let's start with a really common place of holding, which is the neck and the shoulders. I'm going to invite you to open your eyes. If you closed your eyes, so you can see what I'm doing. Take your hands and just place them right here, right where the neck connects to the shoulder. And we're going to use duckbill hands. And I'm making this little quack, quack, this little duckbill. Using duckbill hands, you're going to start squeezing. And you're going to just start squeezing your shoulders near your neck. And then all along the tissue that runs from the neck to the shoulders. And here's the pressure you're looking for. You want to squeeze hard enough that you feel like, oh, I'm being met where I live. You want to meet the tissue. And Kari, I almost see like you're like you would have made a sound. Make a sound.
This feels both good and like I actually feel some sadness coming up, which is really interesting, right? That sense of
absolutely. Thank you. So I want to invite all of our viewers, all of our listeners, notice what arises when you make contact with this place. What arises when you start to meet the tissue where you live, squeezing deeply enough to really connect, but not so deeply that you're causing pain. So it is not no pain, no gain. That's not the point. Mm-hmm. It's how do I create relationship with this activated part of me? And now moving from squeezing to starting to find just one or two spots that are really dense. We talked about density at the beginning, that when the vibration gets lower, we start to harden like water becoming ice. So almost everyone has some boulders. Boulders in their shoulders. And so we're going to start to locate where there's a particular area of tension and start to rock your fingers over back and forth over that tense spot. And we're going to take a breath and make a sound. So what I'd like to invite you to do is imagine that this tense place could make its own sound. Maybe it's angry and the sound is like, you know, maybe it's grief or sadness. And the sound might be very soft, or it may even be crying. And let's make space for that. Maybe it's frustration and it's like, or, you know, just a pile up of stress. So I'm going to talk everyone through, rock it back and forth over that tight spot. Take a deep breath in and let that place speak. And whenever you feel like you've just done a piece of work, I mean, we could spend all day here, but just some piece has moved out on the power of the breath and the sound, go ahead and roll your shoulders around. See if there's any more movement available now than when we started. Yes. And we can even take one arm behind you, all the way behind you, reaching out and stretching it so that you can feel the shoulder blade starting to reach for the spine. So you've got that little bit of a stretch there and coming back. And now the other side.
Ooh, wow. Mm-hmm.
Reaching behind you. Even possibly looking at that hand. Oh, and then looking in the opposite direction. So it's almost as though someone was pulling your hand behind you and you feel that shoulder blade edging towards the spine. Oh. Yeah. Shake it out. there's a whole, I'm not going to go into it fully here, but there's a whole body of trauma work that is literally just tremoring. It's called TRE, trauma release exercises. And it is based on the fact that animals in the wild, despite the fact that they face life and death challenges almost daily, do not end up being permanently traumatized. And one of the things that anthropologists found when they studied why this was so is because animals will tremor. They will just shake out all of that adrenaline and cortisol, even to the point with their tongues are shaking. And they will shake until they have released this.
Yeah, I once saw a rabbit chased by a fox and the fox went off and the rabbit just stayed put for a while, just doing exactly that, like quivering all over. And then it kind of got itself all aligned and looked around and then it was like nothing had happened and it kept on going. It was the most amazing thing.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And we as humans have completely unlearned that. That is our organic response. Is to do exactly what you said. Stay very still, make sure the predator is gone so that you know you're safe. And then as soon as you're safe, shake out the trauma. And that restores you to equilibrium and boom, you're okay.
That's amazing. Oh, I love where you've taken us here. This has just been deeply powerful. And there's so many more places I'd like to go with you. And we're within the containment of 3D space and time.
Yes.
And I would just like to touch on one piece, which I know a big body of your work is actually around eating healthfully, eating in a particular way. And you know, we've just been talking about the trauma piece and the body, but we also get to talk about the body in terms of receiving fuel as energy. Would you share a little bit about what it is to eat in a way? It's not. I'm curious. Is it like a particular diet, or is there something? Yeah. What is this that we're looking
at? That's what I love about it. Is it's not a particular diet, so it doesn't trigger people's feelings of deprivation and restriction, and I'm allowed this and I'm not allowed that. It's a form of exploration that sees all of food as energy. And as having information for us. So Dr. Stone was more interested in the life force of a food than, say, in its mineral and vitamin content. So one of the things that I remember learning early on was you have two oranges. One orange was growing on the tree 2 minutes before you picked it. It was in natural organic soil. It was living. It was breathing. You pick it. You peel it, the spray comes out of the orange, you put a juicy section of it and it's dripping and it explodes in your mouth with flavor. You know, that's one orange. The other orange was grown 3,000 miles across the country.
Those are the oranges I grew up with because I lived in Maine. Everything got shipped to us. They were like ugly little shriveled things.
Ugly little shriveled things that were sprayed with pesticides and herbicides and fungicides and all kinds of chemicals. And then they were picked early. They were picked before they were ripe because they still had to get on a truck and go traveling for a week or however long it took. Then they were stored in the back of the store. They might have been sprayed and irradiated and treated with colorings just to make them look like orange, like oranges, and then brought out to the bins for sale. And Dr. Stone said, I'm sorry, they might be oranges. They are two different species. We want to, you know, if we want to be alive in our bodies, we need to eat living foods. He was very big on sprouts. He was very big on eating things that were fresh and homegrown and alive. One of the things that I remember thinking when I first heard the title of the retreat, which was Wild and Awake, it just made me think I had spent a few months with a vegan vegetarian community. And one of the classes was we went out into the wild and they showed us what the edible weeds were. And I remember them saying, as every gardener knows, weeds are very hard to kill. If you eat the edible ones, the ones that are safe, you become hard to kill. And I remember thinking, wow, I like that. I like that. So Dr. Stone had the view that food had information for us, that the consciousness that they got from the soil. So for example, rather than it being a kind of diet, if you want to be more grounded, eat the foods that have the knowledge of the earth, potatoes, carrots, turnips, radishes, sweet potatoes, all the things that grow deep in the earth, and then slow cook them. None of this fast food stuff. Slow cook the potatoes and the sweet potatoes and raisins and all of this.
You're making me hungry right now. I can feel my body respond. It says, yes, I want to bake a potato.
There you go. That's going to ground you. That's going to be earth energy. That's a wonderful thing to eat as you're trying to like come down from the day rather than, and we don't have time to go into this, but I just love how food connects to the nervous system and how so many people, like I have so many clients who've come in and said, you know, I'm not hungry during the day. I barely eat anything, but at night when I go home, I can't stop eating. And that is directly related to being adrenalized. If you're adrenalized through your day, adrenaline stops your appetite. And then you come home and you have to somehow take down the charge. And one of the things that will take down the charge is food. And what will especially take down the charge is clogging food, like gluten and wheat and cheese and dairy, you know, and, you know, pizza has got, you know, it's this festival of clogging food. And sometimes that's exactly what you need. But the other thing too, is that overeating, eating more than you need, will also clog the system. And people unconsciously will do this at the end of the day because they have to calm down. They have to have some way of down-regulating their nervous system.
Yeah. So what we're talking about is actually, yeah, in the same way we were talking about the nervous system response to traumas, we're talking about our built-in, our natural way of trying to bring ourselves back to a more balanced, neutral state, except that we've revved our engines up so high that it's that the response to bring it back down is one that's, you know, it's a, you know, it takes a lot to slow down a revved engine.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So that's what we're talking about. The, you know, just to end on a high note, the good news is that as you learn more and more about this, and more light bulbs go, oh, that's why I can't stop eating chips at 11 o'clock at night. You know,
right.
You start having these light bulbs of, oh, that's why I'm, that's why this pattern, that's why that pattern, you know, as you start understanding it, that gives you power. Mm-hmm. And now you start having the power to start to make changes because you're not, we have a culture that way overemphasizes willpower and discipline. And I'm sorry, willpower will never trump your nervous system, because your nervous system is your most primitive system designed to ensure that you survive. And willpower will never be more powerful than that. So when you align yourself with the principles of how your nervous system upregulates, downregulates, co-regulates, and starts to come into balance, now you're working with the real force of the universe. You know, you're working with that
aligning. You're aligning. Yes.
That's exactly it. You're aligning. And you know what? This is such a perfect note to start to end on, because when you had asked, you know, what do you think is a life well lived? Even though my first reaction was, oh, that's a question you live your way into, which we had started with, I still sat down and said, what do I consider to be a life well-lived? Because
I'm going to actually realign, because the question is actually, how do I live my best life right now?
How do I live my best life right now? And I would say it's to do exactly what you just said. It's to come into alignment with the true force of nature. It's to come into alignment with your own truth and with the basic energy principles of life.
Yeah. Well, that's a perfect place for us to bring our conversation to a close, Carol. This has just been an absolutely wonderful, rich. I mean, we fit so much in this hour. What an incredible full hour. I think we time warped a little bit here.
I think so too. Thank you so much. This was such a rich, textured, juicy conversation.
Fantastic. I would like to say, if people want to find you, your website, Carol Briskin, that's BRISKIN.com, is yes. a fantastic way to find you, right? And you're offering us a wonderful gift. And this gift is the Nervous System Reset audio. And I just want to encourage people to go to the button underneath this video, get this gift, because it's actually a perfect way to keep working with what we just opened up. And I think we opened up a lot today, and it's really nice to have some place to follow through from there. I'm going to do two things. One is first of all, I want to thank all of the audience for being here. And these conversations are big and juicy. And we're also part of the design of this whole retreat is to engage you in asking bigger questions than perhaps you've asked before, and also allowing yourself to shift and change. So my invitation is, whatever has happened today in this conversation, to take it in, to allow that absorbing of the information, to share it with somebody else. There's been a lot of ahas today, and allow this to actually be part of your life right now. Let this conversation come into you, into your life, absorb it, allow it to be part of your consciousness. Thank you for being here on this, what I see as a journey that, as all of us go on these journeys together, we grow and transform and transcend more collectively. Yeah. Mm. And Carol, for those people who need to jump because it's been an hour, I'm going to encourage you to jump. But would you do that last exercise? I really want to do this last exercise where Carol and I are going to go wild, and we encourage you all to go wild with us. Pretty soon. Yeah, okay. Does that work for you for your time?
Totally.
Okay. Awesome.
Okay. This is one of my favorite.
I'm going to take my hair clip yes, out. Everybody, this is our last hurrah. So join us here, right? Join us. This is the moment of being awake and alive and grounding back in this incredible being that we are.
Oh, what a perfect introduction. So this is my favorite Dr. Stone exercise. It comes from the fire element protocol, and we're going to get down and we're going to scratch. So you're going to start to make claws out of your fingers, and you're going to place them on your head. Warning alert, you're going to mess up your hair. So just let everybody know that.
You have that wild look when we're done.
Wild look when we're done. So you're going to take those claws and you're going to start to circle over your scalp. And what happens is, especially if we've been thinking a lot in front of a computer a lot, the scalp gets pasted onto the skull, and we start losing circulation. So this exercise is designed to open back up that circulation, start to move, get rid of any pastedness, move that scalp over your skull. Start to see. So again, that balance is go deep enough that you can move the tissue, not so deep that you're in pain. So you want to make circles.
So I'm not really scratching. I'm actually trying to move.
Not yet. Out. Scratching comes next. Yeah. Right. That's the next part. So we're starting by just loosening up the territory, loosening up the scalp over the skull. And now we get to the scratching part. We're going to start, take your hands and just start scratching your scalp like crazy. Oh. And the sound you're going to make is a rah. And you want to get the whole scalp. You want to get the top. You want to get the sides. You want to get the back. And the sound is. And go ahead and get the base of the scalp as well, behind the ears, along the temples.
Oh my goodness, this is amazing. I hope you are all doing this with us. This is absolutely amazing. I know we look wild and crazy. I have to say, this is absolutely incredible, Carol.
Okay.
The best hair ever.
Yeah. And now we have wild 80s hair.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone who's with us. Carol, thank you so much for all the gifts of today. Aloha.
Aloha.